there can be coarse language and adult concepts in our program. So please watch out for little ears that might be running around if you've got your podcast playing, or pop on some headphones. And that way no one can get offended but you.
You are the absolute inside track right there.
Yes. Well, should we get on with our interview of you?
Yes, we probably should do that. See, I'm so much better about talking about other people.
It is, isn't it?
So much easier.
No, but this is all about you. This whole week is about you.
Oh, my God. The pressure.
Do you love those weeks?
Not really.
No?
Mm-mm.
We're interviewing now, just so you know. I've started.
Yeah,
I just thought I'd throw that in.
Oh, I thought you were going to give me a 3-second pause and we're going to press record.
Let's just start chatting. You're listening to the Rights for Women podcast, where we talk all things women in writing and women's rights. I'm Kel Butler, the newbie writer with a first draft fiction novel under my belt and another one just begun.
And I'm Pamela Cook, published author and mentor with 4 novels already released and a 5th on its way. Both of us are mums. My kids are older, all in their late teens and early 20s, and Kel's are young. We're both feminists, we're proud advocates for Room to Read, and podcasting partners.
And last year, we chose to launch this podcast, Rights for Women, with no idea what we were doing, and only really one clear goal in mind. That was to celebrate women's voices and support women's rights. To be a positive force for the encouragement and empowerment of women and women writers everywhere. That's really all we knew.
But we know a lot more now, don't we, Kel?
So much more.
It's all about women writing and the female story and living life as women on the Rights for Women podcast.
This week we're talking with Alison Tate. Alison Tate is the author of the amazing Mapmaker Chronicles series, which in our home it's very well loved, going through the second time at the moment, and has just released the second book in the Adaban Cipher series, which is her second series for kids, called The Book of Answers, which follows The Book of Secrets. So this week has been a very exciting week for Alison, and you guys out there might also know Alison from the So You Want to Be a Writer podcast, which we will talk about later, because without that podcast, honestly, Al, I would not be writing. And Val are the reason I have written my first book, and we'll talk about that later. So
no pressure.
I have a lot to thank you guys for. But, yeah, I'd love to know just what's this week like for you, like launch week?
It's actually the strangest week in many ways of any week of my entire life. And it's funny because I've had 3 of them in the last year. So I've had a bit of practice with this, and you would think that I would be all over it by now, but I'm sort of not. But there's this immense building of pressure that you feel, because there's this kind of there's a lot of anxiety around a book coming out. You know, how's it going to be received? Will readers love it? Particularly, I think, with the second book in the Adaban Cipher series, because the first book, The Book of Secrets, which came out in September last year, set up such a huge question. You know, why would you write a book that no one can read? And then, of course, you have to, and the whole book is written in code. So now, you know, the Book of Answers reveals, obviously, all the answers. And there was just this whole thing of like, oh, have I tied everything up properly? It goes through so many editing processes, and yet you still have all of this sort of like concern about how it's going to be revealed. So you have this massive buildup of pressure. There's a lot of intense effort that goes in the weeks before a launch day about, you know, promotion and getting the book out there, talking about the book without, you know, absolutely boring your community to death is always an inventive and exciting process, that kind of stuff. So I'm trying to get the word out. I've got all this anxiety building. And then, you know, the big day arrives and, like, nothing happens. It's the strangest thing. Nothing happens. And you get up, you sort of get up. Natasha Lester and I were talking about this. You know, she's obviously a best-selling author of historical fiction. She does amazing stuff. She's terribly glamorous, like so much more glamorous than I am. And she had a book come out on the same day. And we had this hilarious little Twitter exchange where it was like, you know, yay, it's your big day. Are you doing the school run like I am? Yep. Are you going home to tidy your desk like I am? Yep. What else will you be doing? I've got after school swimming, you know, like it was that, because that's essentially what the day is like in many ways. The other thing that's you sort of don't realize until your book comes out either is that, so launch day might be the 27th of March, but often like bookshops don't even get the book until the afternoon of the 27th of March. Or in Natasha's case, like they're heading over to Perth. They may not be there for a week. So the book's kind of out. But like even my local booksellers say to me, don't come to sign books until Wednesday, because we will have received the courier delivery. We will have unpacked the boxes. We will actually have books on the shelves for you, you know. So it's a funny sort of a, it's a funny sort of a day. But then, you know, online it's amazing because there's so much cheering and there's parades and there's, and this is why I, one of the reasons I say to authors, you know, have a community in place for when that book comes out. Like don't think that you're going to start building an online community or an online presence, you know, when you get a book deal. Have it in place because you need people cheering, because in your actual life, there's not a lot of cheering going on. It's crickets. I mean, I said to the boys, I got home, they came home from school and I said to them, did either of you remember that I had a book coming out today? Oh, they said, was that today? Just like, oh. So, you know, we just sort of, we have a dinner and we have a beer and we all cheer. But I have to say that my lovely publisher, Hachette, sent me a fabulous bottle of Veuve Clicquot, which I will be drinking this weekend. I'm very much looking forward to that.
Ah, oh, lovely. So this is, because this is your fifth book.
No, this is my sixth book. It's my sixth book for children, and it's, I think it's my 10th or 11th book overall.
Yeah.
And, I, you know, people say to me, oh, you know, do you get a bit over it? And no, you don't. I would just like to say you do not get over it. It's in the sense that having a book is so exciting. Like having a book in your hand is so incredibly exciting, and you never really, it never gets old. Like that sense of, wow, there I am in the bookshop. I like to go into bookshops and just look at my books on the shelves, you know, next to all of those amazing authors. And they're starting to take up a bit of space on the bookshop shelves now too, which is really exciting. And libraries, I get a real thrill out of seeing my book in libraries. So that never gets old. And I, you know, I hope that I will get to experience that many more times in my career. So it's, you know, it's just always, you're always working on the next book, basically. By the time the Adaban Cipher, the Book of Answers had come out, you know, I'd completed another two manuscripts. So, you know, it's kind of like, yeah, well, you just,
you've got to keep writing.
Well, yeah, and I think it's the only way to live with that pressure of waiting for books to come out and waiting to see what people think of them. And you just need to be working on something new.
Does it take for you for each one of your books on an average sort of basis from the time that you conceive to publication?
Well, it depends on the, like, so each of the Mapmaker Chronicles books, the first draft has probably taken, well, the very first draft, just that vomit draft, as I like to call it, usually takes me around 6 weeks. So they're about 50,000. The original first draft is probably around 50,000 words, and they usually end up at about 55,000 words, because I am one of those. Not only am I an under-celebrator, but I am also an underwriter. So I'm so busy getting the story down that sometimes, you know, it's in the review that I go back and I put the detail in and I paint the pictures a bit more and I do that sort of stuff. So that first draft took me about 6 weeks, and that would be for each of not only the Mapmaker Chronicles but also those Adaban Cipher books as well. And then I read them out loud to my boys, each of them. It's just to kind of not only to hear what they sound like, to kind of pick up the inconsistencies. I think reading them out loud is a really great way to do that. But also I read them to an audience, you know, to a reader. And they tell me what they really like about them, what they don't. I remember reading the first book of the Mapmaker Chronicles to my son. He's now 14, but he was 9 at the time. And he was like, yeah, no, that's boring, Mum. You need to throw in a battle, you know, stuff like that. Like he would just be like, well, we're going to take the boring bits out, so let's do that. And he's still a terrific, you know, first reader for me. And my youngest son is now 11, and he was probably more involved in the Adaban Cipher series than my older son. He just loves it. Like it's really interesting. It has grabbed him. I'll call him Book Boy Junior because that's probably the best way to. It has grabbed him in a way that the Mapmaker Chronicles didn't. And I think he just loves the friendship angle of it, and he really loves the girls. Like he just thinks the girls in the Adaban Cipher series are fantastic. So it's interesting because it does give me an insight into what, you know, they're different readers. They read in different ways, and it just gives me a way of seeing, you know, maybe what's going to appeal to different readers. And then once I've read them out loud, I go back and I revise them and I sort of add bits in and remove bits and take the boring bits out. And then I send it off to my publisher. And, of course, at that point we then go through, you know, the structural edit and the copy edit and the proofread and all of that sort of stuff. And that process takes longer. But I guess start to finish on average is probably, you know, a year, because the publishing process takes a long time. But I've been working on another story, and it's something that I started about 2 years ago. And I sort of stopped and started with it because, you know, the Adaban Cypher series happened and the fourth Mapmaker Chronicles book happened. And so I kind of got busy with other things. And I'd written about, I don't know, 20,000 words of it, and it kind of just sat there. And then I went back and I revised it, and I realized it wasn't quite right. So I kind of rewrote it. I had to reimagine the character a little bit. So I kind of rewrote that first 20,000, and then I put it aside because last year was really busy with, you know, doing edits and promotion and stuff for all the books that I had coming out. And then I've just gone back to that manuscript again and finished it. And I finally came to grips with a problem that I'd been having with it, and I finally unlocked the story. Wow. And so I managed to write the last 20,000 words quite quickly, and I'm just revising it again at the moment. But that story has taken me 2 years probably to get a draft, you know, to get a draft that I'm happy to send to my publisher. So different stories and take different lengths of time. But once an idea grips me, then I just want to get it out. I want to get it on the page because I'm not a massive planner.
Yeah.
So I have to kind of get the story out very quickly because I want to see what happens.
But that's also the sign of a good story, isn't it? If you're there almost like when you're reading a good book or watching a show and you're stopping halfway through and it's almost annoying because you want to – what's going to happen next? So as you're imagining it, if that imagining is triggering that in you, hopefully I guess you're thinking that's going to trigger that same kind of reaction in your reader.
I think so. A lot of the sort of my stories are fast-paced, and I think it's because I generally like to read fast-paced stories. So there's an element of that sort of, you know, and I think if you can get that level of excitement when you're writing it, then I do feel that that does come across to the reader when they're reading it. I think that they go on that journey with you to an extent. But that's, I mean, all writers are different. Like, we all go about things in different ways, and it's just that that's what works for me. Getting it out as quickly as possible. I have a fair bit of, it's interesting, my first drafts are not that different from what sort of ends up, you know, being published, but it is the level of detail. And in some places what I need to do is to slow it down because, and that's where I'm adding in details, I'm adding in thought processes, I might be adding in some internal monologue or something like that, just to slow the story down a bit in the areas that I really want a reader to get what I'm thinking about, to get where the character is, to sort of understand a character development. There's just that, you know, pacing is so important. It's not just breakneck all the time, although that is what my first drafts often look like. It's understanding where you need to slow a story down and how to do that to bring a reader really into contact with the character and where the character is at. And I think that that's something that you learn as you go as well.
Do you use puzzles in your books as a way of drawing your reader in as well? Because I find the Mapmaker Chronicles uses maps, geography, and puzzles, and there's coding in Adaban Cypher. And I feel like there's almost this symbolic element in your writing that you're trying to capture with your audience. Is that right or wrong? That's just my interpretation, but I feel like you love to give your reader puzzles.
Well, I think I just love puzzles myself. I think, you know, my very favourite genre to read is crime fiction, and it's because I really enjoy the idea of trying to, like, it's that whole notion of an author trying to surprise me and me trying to outwit the author and get the solution earlier so that I can get to the end of the book and go, well, of course. I guess it's an interesting thing. As a reader, I've become very hard to please because I think that, you know, the more you delve into the craft of writing, the more you can see what an author is doing.
Yes.
And so, you know, the more it takes to actually surprise me, which is why when I come across a story that really does grip me, or an author who really does get me all the way to the end, you know, I shout about them to the rooftop. So I think, it's not probably a conscious thing necessarily, but it's definitely, I think you write what you enjoy reading. And I think that I probably put it in from that perspective. But I also think it's partly my audience as well, because, like, to me, that age group, that sort of middle grade age group that I write for, which is sort of 9 to 13, they're on the cusp of one of the biggest adventures and one of the biggest mysteries that any of us ever undertake, which is going through our teenage years and growing up. Mm. And that sense of all the change that is about to happen to them, and all of the things that they're about to go through, and all of the questions that they have, and all of the answers that they're looking for, I think that's what just really captivates me about the entire audience. And I think that maybe that sense comes through in the stories I write for them as well, because they're very much in that area of, like, working out who they are. You know, probably the biggest puzzle that any of us ever, ever undertake, you know, the solution or the solving of. So I think that the kind of books that I write, I guess I'm just trying to add something to that journey that they undertake.
It's interesting, actually, you've said that, focusing on how they have so many questions and answers, and you've created a book of questions and a book of answers for kids of that age group within your own fictional world. I just find that interesting.
I think it's a subconscious thing. So the whole book of questions idea, the Adaban cipher, and again, it comes from your own questions, doesn't it? So I was reading I've always been interested in those old books, like illuminated manuscripts. They just fascinate me. They're so beautiful. And the whole notion of all those monks, you know, sitting around copying these things out and drawing all of those gorgeous pictures. And, you know, if you sort of start looking online, you can find stories about, you know, they used to write messages in the margins and things like that, you know, because they spent a long time sitting in rooms writing stuff, copying stuff. Mostly that's what they did. They copied. They weren't actually, you know, writing. They were copying biblical passages and things like that, and making things beautiful, because books, of course, were seriously expensive things. But I find them so beautiful. And I went to see the Book of Kells. I've been to see it twice. I went when I was in Ireland on two different occasions, because, you know, they open one page a day. So if you're going to see the whole thing, you're pretty much going to go for a year. But I just remember that sense of looking at that book and the history of that book and how old it is and how incredibly beautiful it is. And I just wanted to pick it up and take it home. Like, I really wanted that book, like, in the sense of that real visceral sort of, like, I want to acquire that thing. I want to have it. I remember that sense of how I felt when I looked at it. And then many years later, I heard about the Voynich manuscript, which is a 500-year-old book that somebody found in an attic, Mr. Voynich, found in an attic. You know, he was a bookseller. Somebody found it in their attic and took it to him, and it became known as the Voynich manuscript because he bought it and he had it for many years. But it's written in code. It's this medieval manuscript that is written in code. No one's ever been able to read it. It's not a language that anyone recognised, you know. And I remember reading about it and just thinking, what could this thing be? And I think that when I was kind of where ideas for stories come from is one of those things where they're obviously around you, and yet there's this kind of drawing together of a whole range of different things. And so I think that when I set out to write this story about Gabe, you know, who had grown up in this monastery and had never been outside the walls, you know, could see the world from inside it. He's a foundling, you know, he was found on the doorstep. And, you know, he could see the world outside. And, you know, of course, being in the monastery, like, it was, for me, it was always going to be a book, because books fascinate me. And then the idea of the Voynich manuscript, of being this book written in code. And so the question comes up of, why would you write a book that no one can read? What could it possibly be? And that's, you know, that was pretty much my jumping off point for the whole thing. And obviously, I guess somewhere in my subconscious as well is this idea of that age group with their questions and their answers. And so how did I come from that to 110,000 words? I don't know. But it's I just think as an author, you take your jumping off point and you go with it and see what's going to happen, you know, and it sort of unfolds before you. Like a movie, which is, you know, great. On the days where it's working really well and you've got 3,000 words, you know, coming out of your fingertips, it's brilliant. And on the days where you can't quite work out what the, you know, how to solve the problem, you know, it's 200 words and it's wading through concrete and it's like, I'm never going to finish this book and why did I start this and what was I thinking and all of those sorts of things. So it's a very roller coaster experience.
So do you think storytelling, that the crux of storytelling is the ability to make connections?
I think it is. And I also think, and I, as I've often said on the podcast, you know, my dog goes for a lot of walks because I like to walk when I think.
Yeah.
And for me, storytelling is making connections and it's solving problems because what you're doing, I mean, as I say, when I go to workshops with kids, you know, basically a story is just all about your character confronting problems and making decisions. And depending on what that decision is, it sends the story in direction A or direction B. And, you know, sometimes when you're writing the story, your character makes the wrong decision and you end up, you know, facing a brick wall and you have to backtrack and go back to, you know, category B and, you know, try it from that perspective as well. But problem solving is like, well, okay, I've set this thing up. Yeah, and, you know, my character is now in a dungeon. How am I going to get my character out of this dungeon? How does he – and it has to be a realistic thing. And it's not just a realistic solution for the reader, but it's a realistic solution for that particular character. You know, if my character is a particularly unworldly guy and has no real idea of how to navigate, you know, different problems outside the monastery walls – how is he going to do that? Like, how is he going to solve this particular problem? You know, is his naivety actually going to be a strength in this particular situation? You know, what is it that he is going to bring to this particular problem that is going to come up with a viable solution for the story? So yes, it's making connections. It's and I'm often surprised by things that turn up in my stories because it is very much a subconscious coming to the fore. It's a very funny thing. Valerie, my partner in crime over at So You Want to Be a Writer, often dictates her story. Like she writes nonfiction and she will often dictate her books. I don't think I could actually do that. And I do know a lot of authors who write fiction who do that. But I don't know that I could actually do that because there is something about plugging my brain into a keyboard, you know, via my fingers that brings a whole different side of my thought processes to the fore. And it creates a story that I think is quite different to how it would be if I had to speak it, so to speak.
And would you also say that your writing voice then is so different to your speaking voice that if you were to switch it around, you'd have to almost train your speaking voice to come out as your writing voice? Does that make sense?
It does. It's an interesting question because I don't actually think that they're that different because people often – one thing I would say to authors, you know, aspiring authors, is you need to be able to write the best possible version of your own voice to find your writing voice. If you're trying to come up with a voice that is very different to the way that you talk, I think that you are going to find it very, very difficult to really tap into that inner voice, that inside voice, as I like to call it, that is going to really be the crux of who you are as a writer. One thing people say to me is that when they read my stories, they can hear me. They can hear me speaking. It's almost like particularly people who know me very well, it's like I'm reading the story to them because there's something about the phraseology and something about the humor and something about the words that I put together, the way I put my sentences together, that even if, you know, it's obvious, I mean, obviously I do write a lot better. Like it's the best version of my speaking voice, not just my bloody, bloody, blah voice like you guys are getting at the moment. But the crux of who I am as a writer is you can hear it when I talk and you can also hear it when you read my words. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's something that I've learned. I think I got to the grips with that through blogging, actually, because as a freelance journalist or as a journalist, like I've been through the big houses in Sydney of big publishing houses for magazines and things like that. You learn to speak, you learn to write within the realms of your publication, and also in a sort of like a very broadcast voice, a very outside voice. Mm. And to write fiction, you have to come back to that voice that is only yours. And I think blogging really helped me to do that.
Now, you haven't always written for children, as you said. So I was referencing your children's books before, but you're right. You have a whole lot of other books that you've written prior to finding your voice with children. Mm. Now, that was more commercial fiction. Is that right?
No, in fact, I'm published. The books that I've had published have been mostly outside of children's fiction, have been mostly nonfiction, and were very much based on my work as a freelance journalist. Because that was where I found my writing chops. That was where I found my voice. That was where I had my byline. So I wrote about credit cards. I wrote about going back to work as a mum. I did some ghostwriting work. Yeah. And I did start writing fiction for adults. Yeah. So the first three manuscripts that I ever wrote were commercial women's fiction.
And that's the what story, I'm thinking of.
That's exactly what you're thinking of. And, of course, like you've heard my story so many times, you probably got confused. But so I wrote three manuscripts for women. One of them was a straight romance novel because that's where I really started. When I first started thinking about writing fiction, I tapped into the Romance Writers of Australia, which is a fantastic association for anyone writing. If you're writing fiction that has any form of love element, and let's face it, most of it does somewhere, then I would wholly suggest joining the Romance Writers of Australia Association because they have fantastic workshops. It's a terrific community. They have a conference every year that you can go to and meet other writers and other authors, and you can learn an enormous amount about commercial genre fiction, which I think is very, very, very interesting no matter what you're writing. And so I started out going to their conferences because it made sense to me as a kind of 20-something, this is quite a long time ago I started doing this, as a 20-something woman writing for women's magazines, I understood a lot about the voice. I understood a lot about the target audience. I understood a lot about how category romance worked because it was very much like certain stories went into certain, lines and certain demographics. But what I found when I started writing it was that I really struggled to write something that was kind of my story as opposed to what I thought romance writing should be. I won quite a few competitions and all of the feedback that I got back was, we love the voice of this, but you're writing something you think should be romance, not actual romance. I'm like, oh, okay. So it was almost like I'd ticked off all the boxes, but it just wasn't gelling. I couldn't quite work it out.
Did you feel that yourself? Did you feel that in your writing?
I don't think so. No? I don't think so. Not at the time. Because it was very new to me. Like I'd never really written fiction on that sort of level before. And I knew that I could write. Like I didn't have a question about the fact that I could put sentences together because I'd been making a living from doing that. Yeah. What I hadn't quite got my head around was the difference between writing fiction and writing sort of features. And just that, I guess there was a certain arrogance about me, I will say that, because it was that notion that I needed to go back and learn the craft of writing again for a different purpose.
So your ego kind of hit by that?
Do you think? No, I don't think so. It was because, look, I think one thing that you learn very, very quickly when you write professionally, as I was doing, was that you are going to be rejected. There are going to be people putting red lines through everything that you do. Like I had one particular job where particularly in the first couple of months that I was there, it took me a while to get to grips with what I needed to do. And so every story I wrote came back with red pen through it. But I had been, I had been through some fairly tough schools of chief sub-editors and editors-in-chief at that point. So it was more like, oh, roll your eyes, go back to the drawing board. And this is the other thing I always talk about to new writers, is that rejection is part of it. You know, criticism is part of it. And if you can't learn to take criticism, constructive criticism, I mean, and you can't learn to work with it, and you can't learn to go, okay, you know what, you're actually right about this. If you can't leave your ego at the door to a degree, I mean, you've got to have a healthy ego to write in the first place in a way, because you have to have this notion that the whole world is going to want to read your story. But your ego is going to take a massive battering and a massive bruising, and if you cannot overcome that, if you don't have the resilience to bounce back from that, then you are never going to be published, because the stories of people who write, you know, one draft and get themselves published are, you know, one in a million. And I'm still waiting for my editor to come back to me and say, Alison, this is perfect. You don't need to change another word. And I suspect that I will be waiting, and she would be laughing if she could hear this. I suspect I will be waiting, you know, forever for that day. Yeah, till the day I die. Because, you know, so yes, I was a bit subdued and I was a bit saddened, and I might have, you know, kicked a wall, and I might have, you know, sworn, and I might have told my partner that clearly, you know, partner at the time, that clearly, you know, no one in the world understood my genius, because that's, you know, pretty much what you've got to do. But I went back to the drawing board and I wrote another one. And the second one that I wrote was hilarious, because it won me a mentor. I won a mentor in a competition with my second manuscript, and I sent it off to her for feedback, and she came back to me, and the first thing she said to me was, Alison, I think you need a bigger canvas, because I was again writing category romance. And she was like, you are trying to fit an entire world into this, and you are not focusing on the romance.
That's interesting.
Which made me go, oh, okay. Because I kind of had focused on category romance as a niche, because I thought, again, as I said, I thought I understood, like, I was all over target audiences and, you know, all of that sort of stuff. So I thought it made sense. And then I realized that maybe what made sense to me was actually not what I needed to be doing as a writer. So I went back and I rewrote that story as a bigger story, and it was accepted for publication by a major publishing house. Like, it was bought, I was tearing, it was all going on. And then what happened was that the editor that had acquired the manuscript left the publishing house. And, you know, pretty much every author that you ever speak to has got a story like this. But what basically happens if your editor leaves the publishing house that acquired it is that, you know, the story loses, the book loses its champion. And what happens is I ended up going through a whole range of different editors, a whole range of different structural editors. Nobody could quite decide what they wanted this story to be. I wasn't, I think, at that stage probably confident enough in myself as a writer to say, no, this is what the story is. It needs to stay like this. So I kept making the changes, and I ended up, you know, it just ended up in a mess, and to the point where we all decided in the end that it was probably better that not be my first book out in the market, which, yeah, of course was devastating to me at the time, because you know, you work so hard to get this publishing deal, and then it didn't work. And the only thing, the one and only saving grace for me at that point, was that I had written the Mapmaker Chronicles, and it had been the first book in the Mapmaker Chronicles, and it had been accepted for publication. So I was able to go, okay, so that, you know, that didn't work. And obviously this is, you know, and
it,
the whole,
cushioned the blow.
Well, it cushioned the blow, but it also had given me a really serious insight into what I was good at.
Yeah.
Really serious. Because when I got the idea for the Mapmaker Chronicles, it was a weird thing, because I got the idea for it and I didn't do anything with it, because I wasn't writing children's fiction.
Yeah.
So I'd had these two conversations with my son that had brought this idea to the fore, and we both agreed, my son and I, that this was a great idea. I was like, wow, wouldn't that be a great idea for a story? And he was like, yeah. And then I didn't do anything. 6 months went past. And my agent at the time, so all the argy-bargy was going on with this other book, the edits. I was going through all of this process of editing this other story. And then one day my agent said to me, you know, what are you working on? And I said, well, I had started working on another women's fiction novel, which I finished, and which, you know, is still sort of sitting in a drawer. And she said to me, you know, have you got any ideas for children's fiction? You know, because I've been asked and people are looking for it. And I said, oh, well, I've got this random idea about map makers. And she said to me, she said, okay, well, what is it? And I said, I don't know, because that's not how I work. I'll have to write it for you. And she goes, well, go and write it and then send it to me and we'll see what we can do with it. So I sort of sat down and 6 weeks later I had this 50,000-word manuscript. And she read it and she was like, I love this. This is the best thing you've ever done. And I'm like, okay, good. Let's see what we can do with that then. And, wow, you know.
The serendipity of that is magnificent.
And then suddenly I was, you know, writing 3 books in the series, which I'd never – I mean, that was the other thing. I was like, yeah, it's – but I think it's going to need to be a series because it's about, you know, a race to map the world. And she goes, great, okay, I'll send it off. And then suddenly they came back and they're like, we want this, you know, because I'd had to do an outline of the other books, having no real idea of what it was going to be or where it was going to go. I had an idea of where it was going to finish. That was my saving grace, I think. And then they said to me, okay, but we're going to need more detailed outlines of, you know, books 2 and 3. I'm like, well, I'm just going to have to write those because I don't
That's
really
not
know.
How I work.
Yeah. So, but I have to say, I have learned serious – from writing series fiction, I have learned – to be an outliner. I am not a planner, but I am definitely an outliner. I go into these things with at least an overview of where the story's going.
Well, I guess you have to be able to make enough space for it to arc over an entire series, don't you? Rather than arcs within each book, wouldn't you? And then you'd have an entire series arc as well that you'd have to be following.
You do. And that was a lesson for me too, because of course I'd never written series fiction ever. And suddenly I had, you know, kind of a year to write 2 more books that all had to, and I wanted to do them. What I really wanted for my own peace of mind was to have all 3 books written before the first book came out. And that was pressure I put on myself because the publisher didn't require that. But I just thought, I can't go out promoting this first book without knowing exactly where the story's going to go and that I've finished it. Because I was just like, I had this horror of not being able to, you know, write book 3. Actually, book 2 was the hardest, I have to say, but of not being able to finish this story. So, yeah, you've kind of got this over, like I said, this is the overarching sort of story narrative, and then each book's got to have a complete 3-act structure of its own as well. Yeah. So it's, yeah, it's now, an interesting exercise.
But did you find, so you're there writing women's commercial fiction and then you get pulled into writing this children's sort of, which turned out to be the series, and you'd just been told as well that your world was too big, you're focusing too much on the world. And I find that fascinating that you found your voice in an area where you're creating amazing worlds, huge expansive worlds that these kids are exploring both internally and externally.
I was concentrating very much when I was writing women's fiction, very much on voice. And, you know, my voice is good for that. My voice is great for commercial women's fiction. But I think what I was finding was that the story, I wasn't able to, I mean, you know, like if I went back and looked at that second book now, perhaps it would be a different story. But at that time, as an author, I was relatively new to writing fiction and I was struggling with creating a believable space for myself to tell my stories in with my great voice, you know, which was honed through many years of women's magazines. What I found when I started writing the Mapmaker Chronicles was that I forgot all about all of that stuff and I just got completely and utterly immersed in the story. It was just like I'm writing this story. I had a reader in mind as well because I was very much writing for my boys who love, this is the kind of story that they loved reading. It was the kind of story that I liked reading to them. You know, obviously I had been reading a lot of, you know, children's fiction with the 2 boys and I became absolutely immersed in just the story. And I think that was the key to it for me. And I think if I went back to writing commercial fiction now, it would probably be slightly different. I would probably write more genre again. And I think that it would be very much focused on more on the story and less on the voice. And I think that that was where I kind of went wrong in the first place.
So did you find after doing Mapmaker Chronicles, it's so much easier to be able to construct Adam and Cypher because you'd gone through the whole process of doing a series and so you knew what was coming? Did Adam and Cypher come to you as a series, or was it always meant to be a series?
Yes, well, it was always going to be more than one book because it was just too big a story to be told. I mean, that's essentially what it comes down to for me. I've either got to write 100,000 words, which is not going to suit my, you know, target market on any level, or I have to split it into a series format, you know, with those kinds of stories. Did it come to me as a it was an interesting one for me because obviously switching from the Mapmaker world where I'd known those characters so well, and I was, you know, really like I remember when I was writing the third book of the Mapmaker Chronicles, which is the last book of the first trilogy. I was writing slower and slower and slower because I just had been with these characters for so long, and I didn't want to say goodbye to them. So I was very excited when the fourth Mapmaker book came along. But I wrote the first. I'm just trying to think of the timeline of this because, of course, it all gets a bit hazy. I wrote the first book of the Adaban Cypher series. I wrote the fourth Mapmaker book, then I wrote the first book of the Adaban Cypher series. So it was very much a switch of, you know, like I was totally changing worlds. And it was an interesting one because I had to actively remove myself from Verdania and go to this whole new world. And I think the girls were very much away into that story for me because they were not present in any form. There was nobody like them because Ash is very much a fantastic, you know, girl character in the Mapmaker Chronicles, but she was different. She's very different to the four girls in the Adaban Cypher series. And those four girls with their friendship and their, you know, their characterization and their different skills and their worldliness as opposed to, you know, Gabe's unworldliness, they were the way into the story for me for the Adaban Cypher. I often go into a story through characters. It's you know, I get the character first and then I follow that character through the world and through the story. And it was really actually those girls that brought the story to life for me. Once they appeared in the story, it was like, yes, this is where we're going. This is what this story is, because it was that whole notion of it was interesting because they did appear out of nowhere, as they often do with me. You know, Gabe goes out into the deep dark forest to hide his book, and you know, there were these, you know, and he got held up, and I was like, okay. So then I'm walking around the block with the dog. Who are these people? Who's got him? Why is he held up? What's going on? You know, who's kind of, you know, got an arrow pointed at his chest in the forest? And I was like, of course, it's a group of girls. Of course it is, because what could be more foreign? What could be more foreign to a boy who's grown up in a monastery for 14 years than a group of self-sufficient girls? Yes. And it was just like, and they were there, and they were sort of, you know, up a tree, and they were behind a bush, and they were like, oh, yes, this is brilliant, I love you. And they were all there in their various guises as, you know, as individuals in their own special, with all of them with a role to play, and I just followed them through the story, basically.
Do you get really
Gabe
excited?
And I followed them through the story.
Yeah. When that happens,
yeah.
Does it?
Oh, God, yeah. It's the most exciting moment. It's like you can feel it bodily. Like when you have a moment that is like one of those real aha moments, it's almost like you just get that zing through your whole body, which is just like goosebumps. Yes, that's it.
And you
it.
Just want to go and write it down? Is that what?
Well, that's what we did. Procrastipup and I ran home so that I could, you know, get it all out of my head. So what I basically did at that point was to open up a blank sheet of paper on a blank, you know, file on my computer and just download my brain of everything I knew about those girls. I didn't even have names for them at that point, but I knew who they were. So it was just like, you know, this one is this and this one is that and this one is this and this one is that. And then once I had the four of them there, you know, I was able to name them and then off we went.
And it was like it unlocked everything.
Mm.
So do you do character outlines and breakdowns? I know you don't plot. I know you're very much a pantser. But when you're evolving your characters, do you have, you know, a document for each character that you'll throw information into as it comes to you or things like that so you can go back, especially in writing a series and making sure that it's all continuous?
Yes. So with the Mapmaker Chronicles, I very much had a series Bible, and I still it's like I printed that out, and it's all in a folder, and it's a list of because it got so complicated as to who was in what country and what we were doing and kingdoms and who spoke what languages was one of my biggest issues. It's like who speaks, you know, Vedanyan, and who's got Suspite and who can talk this one. And because, of course, you know, when you've got people switching languages all the time, and the brilliant thing about Quinn, of course, is his photographic memory and his, you know, obviously like his gift for languages and things like that. But I had to keep track of what he could say to who in what language so that, you know, everybody knew what was going on. With the Ataban cipher, I don't think I've actually got around to printing it out yet, but it's more of a that's what I basically do is I open up one document, I put all the characters in there, I have a paragraph description of all of them to start with, and then if anything startling turns up about them as we're going through, I add it in to that. The authorly subconscious, like the writerly subconscious, is an amazing thing because things come out in your writing and themes come out in your writing that you just don't even realize are there until someone reads the book and says, I loved the way that you brought out X, Y, or Z in your story. And you go, oh, wow, you know what? You're right. I hadn't even thought of it that way before. So it's, and people who read and analyze your books will often find things in your stories that you don't even realize were there.
I'd love to sort of talk to you as well, just switching gears a bit, about So You Want to Be a Writer, the podcast.
Oh, yeah.
How did that come about?
Oh, as with Valerie and I, how most things come about, it was just kind of an excuse to talk to each other every week, really, I think, to start with. So we've known each other for a long time. We worked together at Clio back in the day, as they say. And we'd sort of like, you know, just kept in touch, you know, over that, you know, with that sort of thing. And then I started doing some work with her, you know, as an online tutor. So I actually tutor in magazine and features writing during the online courses for the Australian Writers Centre. So we were kind of back in touch from that sort of thing. And we also ended up doing, because she's really, you know, she's pretty amazing. She's a force of nature, that woman.
I can't believe what she does. She blows my mind constantly.
She's incredible. I mean, we have had a few talks lately about the fact that she probably does need to sleep at some point.
Does she sleep?
No, I don't think so. I think she's I don't know how she manages to do what she does.
She's like a Wonder Woman of creativity.
She's
good at everything.
I know. She's kind of, you
know. Is there anything she's crap at? Like, seriously?
No, I don't. Oh, cooking. She's not good at that.
Oh, okay. There's got to be something.
She's really not good at cooking. I'm glad that we're friends because otherwise, you know, she would be very easy to hate, really, wouldn't she? But we started doing, Kerry Sackville, who is an author and writer as well, she was also working, doing some teaching at the Australian Writers' Centre in social media stuff. And we started a funny little podcast, which we called, gosh, I can't even remember now, called Smack Talk or something like that. It was a social media chicks or, I don't know, something. And we used to sort of like get together once a week and talk about stuff that was going on. But we found it very difficult to keep this. Our schedules were ridiculous. And with three of us, it was too hard to manage the various things that we were doing. But we were also being asked to present at various conferences as a sort of duo or as a trio because we talked about writing and because I was teaching writing and writing books and doing various things. And obviously Valerie's the CEO of the Australian Writers' Centre. So she kind of like rang me up one day and said, look, I've had this idea, how about we just do this one about writing? It made a lot more sense to me with what I was doing at the time and all of that sort of stuff than sort of like just getting together to talk about whatever was going on in the news, which is what our original podcast was. So I was like, yeah, let's do that. Oh, and why don't we do author rather than just the two of us talking to each other? Let's do author interviews. And, you know, anyway, we went from there. And if you listen to our first episode, because we've been, honestly, I think we're into our fourth year now. We have been talking to each other incessantly for 4 years. If you listen to our early ones, they're hilarious. Like I just cringe listening to our early podcasts. And now you listen to us and it's like, you know, we're sitting around in our dressing gowns with our feet up, you know, smoking a cigar, chatting
to each other. It's so comfortable now. Yeah, the two of you. It's wonderful though. That's what
it's so
is so pleasurable to listen to is the
but
comfort.
We just really like each other and I think we're similar enough but different enough. to kind of keep things. I mean, I think I said recently that we're kind of like Eeyore and Tigger when we talk to each other, because she's so enthusiastic about so many things, and I'm like, yeah, fair to middling. But I think that we, you know, she just has such a huge amount of information at her fingertips about a whole range of different things. And obviously over the years of writing that I've been doing and the fiction and of the various, you know, areas in which I write or have written, I just think we bring in different perspectives but enough similarities, I think, for it not to be, you know, antagonistic all the time, which I think some can be.
No, I think you actually beautifully complement each other, because in many ways you're quite opposite, and that absolutely comes across. But it's fantastic for somebody who wants to become a writer or who's questioning it, or even someone who is writing, because you get both ends of that spectrum. You get two different perspectives on the same situation, and you can then choose which way feels best for you.
Well, and that I think is the key to it, because I think the thing that we always talk about is that what works for one person as a writer is not going to work for everybody. So what we try to do is, and this is, you know, the key with our author interviews as well, is just to try to get as many perspectives as we possibly can. We're very much, and we always have been, about being useful. Like we really want people to walk away from listening to the podcast having learned one thing, you know, that is that they can actually apply to their own situation. And that one thing will be different for everybody, because, you know, what you need that particular week will be a different thing to what somebody else needs in a particular week. And, I mean, for me, the absolute best thing about the whole thing is interviewing other authors. I learn so much from talking to other people, and often I will just choose somebody based on wanting to ask them one question that I've been wanting to know the answer to for a long time. So I'll do an entire half hour interview just to get the one thing that I want to know. So it's, you know, I think it's a genuine interest and love of writing and authors and writers that keeps us doing it, really.
Well, also, you know what to get out of authors. It's like, it's quite obvious you and Val are, you know, writers immersed in writing, in a writing community, because when you speak to authors, you speak from that perspective, and you also know the things that new people would need to hear. So you pull out all the right information in the interesting stories.
Oh, well, I'm really pleased to hear you say that, because, you know, when you're doing it week in, week out, you sometimes forget what you're even there for. But I, you know, one thing that Valerie and I are both incredibly experienced in over, you know, many, let's not even talk about how many years, is interviewing.
Well, you certainly definitely feed the writer in your podcast. And for myself, I spent probably a year listening to you and Val before I got the moxie to actually write a word on a page properly. And but what was interesting, and this is where I love the two different perspectives, I needed your no-nonsense attitude to just getting your words on a page. And I would listen to you and Val, but particularly you, Al, every week, almost like my little personal coach, to give me that boot up the bum to go, listen, everybody's riding around the corners. Everybody's got kids. Everybody's busy. You've just got to find those moments. And if you put 50 words on, you put 50 words on. If you put 3,000, you put 3,000. If it's crap, it's crap. But it's the writing, and it was just reinforcing. I just needed that no-nonsense approach. I didn't want to be mollycoddled. I didn't need to be patted. Oh, it's okay. I needed someone to kick me up the butt and go, you either get your act together and do it or you don't. But if you want to be a writer, you've got to write words. And that, for a year, got me there. And then you told me about NaNoWriMo on the podcast, you and Val, and I went, right, okay, I developed my idea, I have my story, I've been dicking around, frankly, for about 6 months, and I went, I'm going to use this as the impetus, and you guys had talked about how you had used it, and you do it, and you follow it, and you put your word count up, and I went, right, and I did, and I got 35,000 words, I think, or 33,000 words, that particular NaNoWriMo, and I've now finished that book, and it has to go into some serious revision. And I've started my second one, but I would not have put a word on a page if it wasn't for the boot camp that So You Want to Be a Writer put me through for the first 12 months before I started. And that was that was all you guys. Yeah.
So that just gives me nightmares. We reach a lot of people now. Like it takes a long time to build a podcast, but we do reach a lot of people now. And the notion of all those people, you know, and people are always like, yeah, I'm listening to you in my car and I'm listening to you. And I think of you all driving around with me in your head going, just get on with it. It's hilarious. But, you know, it's obviously what a lot of people need because, you know, the Make Time to Write and the Creative Writing Bootcamp courses that I do for the Australian Writers' Centre are incredibly popular. And I'm sure it's because I think it's the self-discipline required to sit down every day and write words is really hard to develop. Like it's taken me like an entire career. I did freelance journalism for years, you know, before I got into this business of writing, you know, fiction and stuff like that. And that it is very much a habit. It's like any habit, you know, you need time to form the habit and you need time to break old habits. And so I think the reason that those courses are so popular is, you know, there I am in your inbox every day saying, come on, let's do it. We're doing this today. Or, you know what? We're not doing this today because that's the other thing. I think this whole business of you must write every day and you must blah, 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 you must drives me crazy. I just think it's a matter of learning what works for you. And, you know, you will never write the book unless you write the book. But you've got to work out when is the best time to write the book for you. And I just honestly think that if you can identify that wasted time in your day, like the soccer practice stuff and the sitting around at the dental appointment or whatever it is that you're doing, if you can identify that, or do you really need to watch that episode of Married at First Sight? Probably not. Just quietly.
I've never watched one.
No, but and neither have I.
But
and that's
no,
the thing.
It's true.
I just think, you know, people, if you can identify the stuff that you're doing instead of writing or the spots where you could be writing, where you're really just sitting there staring at your kid running in circles on a rugby field, then if you can find those spots, it's just incredible how those words add up. And I talk about it when I do the hashtag write a book with Al, you know, stuff that I do every once in a while. It's drip, drip, drip. And before you know, you've got a puddle. And, you know, before you know, that puddle becomes a, you know, flood through your kitchen. It's just a matter of doing it. And once you've got the words on the page, you can fix them. Mm. You can't fix the blank page. I mean, it's so many writers say that, but you can't because there's nothing there to do.
You also taught me, and Val very much as well, both of you through this process, that the imagining is a part of the writing and that the research is a part of the writing. So it's not always just putting the words on the page.
No.
But if you're, you know, as you go with Procrasto Pup, shout out to Procrasto Pup here, and you're imagining
he
your story.
He already gets enough attention. He's
that
blushing.
Pup, he's the most famous pup on Instagram.
I know, it's hilarious. Hilarious. But yeah, no, yeah. I am. All of that stuff, like where I talk about, you know, the problem solving. I mean, as I said, I need to be doing something. I need to be able to tuck it into the back of my brain and do something. I need to weed the garden. I need to walk the dog. Washing the dishes is good. Agatha Christie has actually talked about the fact that she wrote most of her books while washing the dishes. It's that mindless, repetitive task seems to unlock somewhere in my brain. It sort of gives my brain the freedom to think about other things. I am so often accused in this town because I live in a relatively small town, and I am so often accused of ignoring people on the street, like walking past them with my dog, and it's because I don't even see them. I'm honestly so far deep into my own head that we walk the same path every time, so I can pretty much do it on autopilot. It takes me sort of just under an hour to do the whole route, and we walk, and I sort of like the whole time I'm walking, I am staring unseeingly, making sure we don't get run over, at the road and thinking about something else entirely. And people honestly, this like you walk past me, Al, and I'm like, really? Did I? I didn't. I'm sorry. I didn't even see you.
Didn't even recognize I was walking on a footpath, really.
Didn't even know
my
I was
brain.
Here. Absolutely.
Yeah. But it's in a completely different universe.
Yeah. I call it active meditation because I'm trying to make it sound really, you know, impressive and mindful, but it's not at all.
It actually makes complete sense, though.
It works for me. It may not work for you, but give it a go. If you're kind of, and that time, by the time I come back, I know what I want to write, and so it takes me much less time to actually get the words down.
Good idea. I know a few people who write like that, actually. I was talking to another author a couple of weeks ago, and she was saying a very similar thing, that she would go and then sort it all out and then come back and just punch it out. But she can't actually start typing until she's done that imagining first. It has to all be there for her.
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of authors work like that, because that way you're then just writing down what you can already see rather than sitting there waiting for inspiration to hit you.
Mm. I have a question. Because you're a mum, I'm a mum, and there's lots of mums out there, and dads.
Hello, mums.
Hi, mums and dads.
Yeah.
So one of the biggest challenges I'm finding in learning how to write around the edges with the kids and all that kind of thing is actually one of the things that stops me writing is going into my writing head becomes this thing that kind of possesses me. When I'm going into the story, I'm sure everyone knows this, but when I switch out to have to be back with the kids, that kind of thing. So I find that really hard. It's almost like I get stuck in limbo. Does that make sense?
Yeah, like it does make sense.
And I'm not with my book, and I want to be with my book, and I want to be with the kids, and I'm not with either of them.
Yeah, no, and I have to say that I do. Particularly if I'm struggling with something, if I'm really struggling with a problem, you know, in the story, I remember there was a particularly lovely moment in Mapmaker 2, which is Prisoner of the Black Hawk, where I had put Quinn down a hole, like a really deep hole, literally down a deep hole in the jungle, and he was down there and there were people, like his enemies were at the top, and he was in there with a couple of other guys, and I could not for the life of me work out how to get him out. Like I could not for the life of me figure out what the story, this is right in the middle of the middle book of the trilogy. I mean, which is the worst place. It was like being in a black hole. It was the worst place to be. And I was struggling so much to get him out. It took me ages. I reckon it took me 2 weeks to come up with a solution. So that's 2 weeks of a lot of walking the dog and weeding the garden and doing all those things. And being with the boys who at that stage were much younger, again, sort of around that sort of 9 and 6, 7 and 10 age group. So they're therefore a lot more high maintenance than they are now, kind of annoying. I was very distracted, and I found that really difficult in the sense of because I just couldn't figure out what was going on with the book, and it was making me anxious. And that's probably the worst time I've had of it. For the most part, now it's very much like I do my words for the day at whatever time I do them. I get anxious if I haven't got them done and I know I'm going to have to do them late at night. It makes it worse, you know, but at least I know, well, everyone's going to go to bed at, you know, whatever time, 9, 9:30, 10, whatever. I'll do them then. I always feel better once the words are done. But, look, I just think it's one of those things where, it comes down to practice, and I just don't think you can be that precious as a writer. I think you just have to realise that at the end of the day, you've got your responsibilities. Paid work always comes first. You know, unfortunately, tying kids' shoelaces to get them out the door for school always comes first. Feeding them, oh, my God, do they need feeding every day? Apparently they do.
Multiple times, it seems.
Yeah, that kind of stuff. You know, you've got to do what you've got to do. And you have to and I always say, what I say to my kids as well, you do what you have to do first, then you do what you want to do. Mm. So I get through the have-to-do stuff and then I do the writing. If that's the way the day works out, the writing then happens at 10 o'clock at night. The writing happened at 10 o'clock at night for the first 6 years or more of my entire, you know, writing career. It's only in the last year or two that I've been able to move it into my actual working day because I get paid for it now, whereas I wasn't getting paid for it. So the paid work always comes first.
Mm. So you can shift it into a higher priority position now.
Yeah, and you just that's an active decision that you make, you know. And at the end of the day, you know, your kids are going to come first, and it's one of the most difficult things as a parent sometimes, particularly when they're little, but they won't be little forever. So keep doing the writing when you can because they won't be little forever. And when they're not little, you want to actually be in a position where you've written a manuscript and you can send it out, or you're on to your third one, so you're actually getting quite good at it. You know, stuff like that. Don't put it off until they're bigger, because then you're starting from scratch. Whereas if you manage to make it work, if you manage to get 200 words done today or 200 words done tomorrow, then, you know, by the end of the week, you do that 5 days a week, you've got 1,000 words. You do that every week for a year, you know, you've got 52,000 words, even though they may not necessarily be coherent. And even though you may forget what you did when you started, you've got 52,000 words on the page ready for you to massage or work on when the kids are bigger or when you've got more time or when the you can shift the priorities of your life around a little bit and move it into the middle of the day. But if you wait until they're bigger, then you're starting from scratch and it's, you know, it makes it so much harder for you.
See, right there, that's what got me writing my words.
Yay!
What you did right there, that's what's got so many thousands of people out there writing words. That's
well,
your power.
Don't think you can wait. It's like people who say, I'm going to wait till I retire. I'm going to wait till the kids are bigger. I'm going to wait till whatever. It's that whole notion of if I could just work 3 days a week and, or even if I could work 4 days a week and have one day for writing, I'm sure I'd be a published author. It's like, no, you would just be someone who wastes an extra day a week. Like, well, really.
Pamela Freeman's partner wrote his book on the commute.
Yes, and a lot of people do that too. And I think that's brilliant because, you know, particularly if you've got a lengthy commute on a train, well, you know, again, 200
using
words.
The minutes.
It's only a paragraph or two. And if you just get that stuff going, and it's amazing. I think the difficulty people have is the starting. You're sitting there on the train and you think, oh, God, the last thing I feel like doing right now is whipping out my iPad and writing 200 words. But what actually happens is you whip your iPad out, you write your 200, and you find that you've got yourself a bit of a flow going. So what you end up with is 500.
Mm.
Or you might even start out. I often do the 500 in 30 challenge because it makes me go, it's only half an hour, it's only 500 words. And what I usually find is that by the time I've done it, I've got 800 words or 1,000 words. I do type pretty quickly, as we said. But, you know, like it's the starting that is difficult. And I think if you can overcome the challenge of the starting, then you can build a manuscript relatively quickly.
And find the ways you dance around yourself as well.
Oh, yeah.
That's another thing that you taught me was, and I didn't realize how many things I would do before, like a cat fluffs around before it curls up and sits down, before I'd actually sit in my chair and write. And then you start identifying, oh, this is my dance.
Yeah.
Right. So really I just need to sit down and write.
That's exactly right.
I don't need to make that other cup of tea. And
no. But she's, you know what, I get it. I procrastinate. I mean, it's one of those things where, it's so much easier to say than it is to do some days. And, I mean, I have to give myself a kick up the butt some days. I'll be sitting there going, geez, Alison, like seriously, how many coffees does a person need before their teeth are chattering? Like, you know, it's kind of, you know, and I always find that, again, it's that moment just before you begin that is the worst because once you start, you're off. You're off and racing and, you know, or not racing.
And then you don't want to stop. And then you're upset because you have to stop.
The number of days that I will go, oh, I haven't written anything, I need to start writing, is 20 to 3.
Yeah.
And my son, my youngest son, Book Boy Junior, finishes school at 3. It takes him 10 minutes to walk home, so I know he's in the door at 10 past 3. It's 20 to 3. I haven't done anything all day on my fiction. I need to get some words down. So I start. And, of course, then the next thing he's knocking on the back door going, Mom, let me in because he's home. And I'm so into the story that I haven't even realised that the time's gone past. So, you know, don't do that to yourself either. That's terrible.
Exactly. You're such a wealth of information, Alison. What's next? What's coming up next for you? I'd love to see you a TV series of one of these series, by the way.
Well, you know, the rights for the Mapmaker Chronicles were optioned for film and television, but that's one of those things that you have absolutely no control over. Mm-hmm. Like you just, you know, you can sign the rights option and then you basically just have to cross your fingers and hope that somebody's interested because that's pretty much how it works. What's next for me? I think, I don't know, maybe a good lie down. I've got a book on submission at the moment. I'm just, as I said, doing those last kind of tweaks towards to that book that I've been working on for a couple of years, which I'm about to send to my publisher. The Adaban Cipher series will come out in the US in January next year.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll have to think about how I'm going to, what I can do from here to kind of help facilitate a successful launch of that in the US. And more books. Like I have another manuscript that I've written about 20,000 words of that I put away because I was doing whatever I was doing. And so now I need to drag that out into the light again and have another look at it. I've had a rethink of that as I've been walking around the block, and I think I'm going to tweak that, change it slightly. I've written it from one point of view. I think I've got two main characters. I'm going to change the point of view and write it from the other. So, you know, it's just all just what do you do? You just keep going, don't you? You keep writing. That's what I'm doing. I'm going to keep writing.
Well, please do, because what you write is fantastic. And I know that myself and my kids have loved it so far. We haven't hit the Ataban Cipher series yet. We're about to do that one together. So I'm very excited to do that with them. I've had a read myself.
I hope you enjoy it.
I haven't read it to Cody yet. But finally, I just want to ask the questions we ask everybody. What is your favourite – who is your favourite female writer or author?
Oh, that's a good question. I think my favourite female writer at the moment is probably Leanne Moriarty, and I love her because I love her voice. I think it was one of those things when I was writing commercial fiction, I think what I was trying to achieve was a voice like hers, and I think I was too focused on that and forgot the story, whereas she manages to combine both of those things beautifully. I think she's probably my number one at present.
And who is your favourite female character in a book?
Hermione Granger, without hesitation.
Why? Why Hermione?
Because I think she's the hero of that series she's a little bit like, to me, I often like the friend. I really like Samwise Gamgee in The Lord of the Rings as well. Yeah. I often like the offsider better than I like the main character, because I think so much rests on them, and the support that they give the main character is so vital to every story. I just think she was the smartest person in every single room that she was in, and I have so much admiration for that.
And layered. I think it's very easy to underestimate the Hermione character.
Yeah, I think so.
And if there was a piece of advice you could go back in time and give yourself as a writer, what would it be to your younger self?
Oh, start earlier, babe. Like, why? What were you doing? I think the problem I had was that I was a voracious, voracious reader, and I have always been. Like, I was a bit like book boy who, you know, started reading at the age of, you know, five. You read Harry Potter when he was about six, and he, you know, just consumed books ever since. And I was exactly like that. I read the library dry by the time I was about 9 years old. But to me, authors were these magical unicorns. Like, I just never occurred to me I could be one. I never occurred to me. And that's why I think it's so great that we have so many, you know, school visits and author talks and stuff now, because authors going to schools shows a kid like me that, you know, a mum from the South Coast can be a writer. Well, if she can do it, why can't I? Do you know what I mean? So I just sort of think, well, I would probably say to myself that I just wish that I had that self-belief to get started much, much sooner. Start sooner. Start now.
Yeah, and to have kids hear you say that about yourself, to say don't wait, don't go, I can't be a writer, that we're all these magical things. It shatters that illusion and gives them – you're giving them a gift.
Oh, it's so funny because, you know, people will say to me, you know, they'll come up to me with their 10-year-old and they'll say to me, oh, you know, he's writing a novel, and they'll roll their eyes. And I will get down to that 10-year-old's level and I will say, you go. You start now. You write as many novels as you need to, because then you will be published by the time you are 21, because you will have written 107 manuscripts by that stage. Do you know what I mean? Like, I just – it takes so long to learn to write a novel. It takes so many attempts, and it takes such a lot of thought process, because all the things that you think you know about writing novels are probably wrong. And you don't realize until you write one, if you write two or three, how you write a novel. Because the way that you write a novel is different to the way that I would go about writing a novel. So it's really important, you know, I just think if you write your first novel at 10 or 15 or whatever it is, then I think, brilliant, do it, go now.
I'm going to end actually not on you, but very quickly on Book Boy.
Oh, Book Boy.
Because you've mentioned him a few times, so I think it's okay to talk about him. And he's on YouTube now. So, and he's got his own, exactly, the reviews. So tell us about Book Boy. Give him a plug too, because I love Book Boy.
Okay, well, so Book Boy is a highly entertaining creature. So he's my 14. He's now 14 book boy. And he started, he's one of those kids who's, when I talk to kids in schools, and I talk to them about the inspiration for the Mapmaker Chronicles, and I say how, you know, I was having these conversations with my, it came from two conversations that I had with him. And I always describe him as that kid, you know, the kid who asks the head hurting questions, you know, the one that you're sitting in class and the clock is ticking down and it's almost recess. And then this kid puts his hand up and says, you know, why is the sky blue, or how do they make brown paint, or, you know, whatever it might be. He's that kid. So I've grown up with this kid with the head hurting question, or he's grown up with me, this kid with the head hurting questions. And he's always been a voracious reader. Like, he's just, he's a reader. There are people who are born readers and people who are, come to it a little bit more reluctantly. Lucas, who is my other son, Book Boy Junior, he also enjoys reading, but not to the same extent. Like, he's not the, I must read the cereal box if there is nothing else to read, kind of reader. So, which I recognize because I was that reader as well. So I just have been throwing books at that child for, you know, forever. And then when he was about 12, he decided that he would, he saw a, there's a young writer called, Jazzy. She's a young book blogger. And I had gone to a school talk and I had met Jazzy, and I showed Book Boy her blog and said, look, she writes book reviews and stuff like that. And he goes, oh, I want to do that. So we started a blog called bookboy.com.au. And of course he, at that stage, was reviewing at least one book a week because he was, in grade six, or year seven, maybe year seven. And he had still had quite a bit of time. He's slowed down a bit now cause he's 14. But the blog is still there, and he, and Book Boy Junior also reviews on the blog. So there's a lot of book reviews on there for kids, by kids, which I think is great, and also by boys, which is, you know, the entire book industry thinks is some kind of, you know, miracle. And so he has his book review blog. He also is a member of the Love Ozwaye committee now. He's their first team member. So he's been doing that for a couple of months. He goes to his Skype meetings, takes notes. It's all very exciting. So he's involved in sort of helping to promote, you know, YA fiction in Australia, which is really exciting. And he, look, he's just, he likes to read and write, and he also is a musician. He writes songs, and he released his first EP last year. His actual name is Joe Visser. So he released very imaginatively titled EP called Joe Visser EP number one, which features six original songs. So I found myself in the fascinating position of becoming a roadie and driving him, you know, I basically drive the car and carry the guitar to all the various gigs that he goes to, because he now has all these gigs that he does, gets up and does his half hour set and all this kind of stuff. So yeah, he's an interesting kid. And I think he just is what he is. You know, people say to me, what do you do with him at home to make him this person? And I'm like, nothing. I don't do anything except throw books at him. That's all I do. I think you either are that kid or you're not, in many, many ways. But I think as a parent, all I can do is actively encourage my – I have actively encouraged both of my boys to read from birth, basically. I remember reading Green Eggs and Ham to both of them when they were sort of, you know, lying there in their wonder suits, gurgling at me sort of thing, because I was so bored. It was just, you know, you're sitting there at home with this baby who looks at you and doesn't speak, yeah. But you have to be there actively supervising. So you can't, you know, be doing something else. You can't be, you know, off writing or whatever, because you've got this kid sitting there in the bassinet or whatever. So I used to read, I would read whatever I was reading at the time out loud to them. So there was a lot of inappropriate content, but I would also then read Green Eggs and Ham. And I remember people saying to me, you do realize that they can't, you know, they don't understand. I'm like, yeah, but they like the sound of your voice.
But language too.
And it gives me something to do. So.
Yeah. Oh, wow, Alison, an amazing chat today. I could talk to you for more hours, but we both have things to do.
I'm thank so sorry. You I feel so like much. I've just banged on. Like we've been talking for hours. And thank you to all those podcast listeners who have stuck with us to the end, because I really appreciate that. I better go and write something.
Yes.
All right. Well, it was lovely to talk, Kel. Thank you so much for having me on today. I really appreciate the opportunity, and I love obviously talking about writing. It's not often I talk about my own writing to quite that length, so it's a great privilege to be able to do that as well. I appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, it's been a privilege to listen to it, and I know that anyone who's listening to this who's a writer or wants to be a writer has gotten a huge amount out of it, and I've got tips that I'm going to go back and apply. So even just doing an interview with you, I'm getting more out of you.
That's why I do author interviews on my podcast. It's amazing what you can learn, isn't it? Fantastic.
That was author Alison Tate talking all about her writing process and the launch of her new book, The Adaban Cipher. Book of Answers, following the Book of Secrets. You can go check that one out at any good bookshop now. It launched on March the 27th. You can find out more about Alison on her website with her fantastic blog for writers at alisontate.com, or just go and listen to her talk about her whole writing process and interview other fantastic authors on the podcast So You Want to Be a Writer, which you can subscribe to in iTunes. The other place you can go to find out more from Alison is the Australian Writers Centre, because that's where she does all her fantastic courses, like the Writers Boot Camp, which will keep you writing for a good month at least. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Writes for Women podcast. We hope you enjoyed hearing all about Alison today, and we're going to bring you a lot more in the not too distant future. I do apologise for the sporadic nature of our episodes dropping at the moment. We are juggling a lot. And yes, it means that some things are sometimes going on the back burner. And a lot of the time, it's my editing. So if you can please bear with me, you should find that a whole heap of episodes start dropping in the next week. Throughout May, we're going to be dropping interviews with speakers who are going to be featured at the Feminist Writers Festival. So take a look out for those. They're going to be sort of mini interviews, around half an hour each. To keep up with everything we're doing, go to our website, www.writesforwomen.com. Check us out on Facebook at Writes for Women, or hit us up on Twitter at W4W Podcast. And don't forget to subscribe in iTunes. Tell your friends about us, give us a good rating and review if you think we deserve it, because that lets other people know that we're out there and listen to us as well. You can also follow myself, Kel Butler, and Pamela Cook on Twitter and Facebook. So go check us all out. You can see what Pamela Cook is up to on her website, www.pamelacook.com.au. And have a wonderful day, and just keep writing.